Good afternoon and welcome to a very special edition of The LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, October 23rd, 2010. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. In 10 days, Americans will vote in the midterm elections. While the media is filled with stories and polls, mostly about how the Democrats are fighting the Republicans and the Republicans are fighting the Democrats, the nation is actually plunging towards hell. There are two things which are clear as we head to Election Day. First, that the American people are legitimately angry and frustrated as the economy continues to crash, and neither the President nor the Congress is doing anything to address the escalating economic and financial collapse and the devastating effects on the living standards of the American people. Secondly, with the exception of what Lyndon LaRouche and the LaRouche candidates for Congress, Keisha Rogers in the 22nd District of Texas and Summer Shields in San Francisco, California, with the exception of what they're putting forward, there's no serious alternative being presented by either party. In fact, it's even worse than that. We're headed into a global hyperinflationary breakdown, a Weimar 1923-style explosion, only this time on a global scale. And President Barack Obama is running across the country like a madman, trying to whip up support from the handful of remaining Obama zombies from the 2008 period, while the effects of his policies are beginning to result in mass deaths, as we can see occurring today in Haiti with the outbreak of the cholera epidemic that Lyndon LaRouche warned would happen if Obama continued his policies. For those self-deluded fools who say, well, wait until November 3rd after the election or until January 2011 when a new Congress is sworn in, we say simply, we cannot wait. There will be no change as long as Obama remains in the White House. There are solutions, of course, which would work, solutions that have been repeatedly presented by Lyndon LaRouche in his webcasts, in his weekly reports, and his writings, and solutions which would not only turn around the economy, but would remoralize the populations of all nations. But they will not be implemented until Obama is removed as president. LaRouche has identified the most efficient way to do this. Use the 25th Amendment to remove President Obama, as he has proven to be incapable of fulfilling the duties of his office. On the LaRouche Show today, we're going to discuss both the dangerously escalating crisis as well as we must do. And by the way, when I say we, I mean those of you listening today. And we have to do it if we're going to prevent civilization from the genocidal effects of a deepening new dark age, which threatens to wipe out about 5 billion people. Joining me today on the program is one of the only strategic thinkers on the planet who has both provided in-depth analysis of this crisis as it has unfolded, but has also given us an example of courageous leadership. I'm very happy to welcome to the LaRouche Show today Helga Zepp LaRouche. And Helga, welcome to the show. It's really good to have you with us today.
Yes, I'm very happy to be with you.
Well, let's begin at the top. I wanted you on the program because I think people need to get a clear picture of what we face, and you're one of the few people who tell us it like it is, as we say in the United States. So from the top, what are we facing in the days and weeks ahead if Obama is not removed from the White House?
Well, there is no question that this financial system is absolutely finished. And the danger is that the situation can spin out of control very, very rapidly. And when you pass a certain point in history, there comes a point when it is too late. I think that the biggest problem is that people somehow mix up history with soap operas. They think that you can have a telenovela for 10, 20 years and the main characters change, but the story goes on and on. But real life is not in such a way at all. You can have sudden developments which completely change the situation, from bad to worse, to hopeless. And we are right now in such a period where we have to assume that, you know, this is about to happen. Now, the situation in the United States, I thought that one of the most remarkable articles on this was in Time magazine a couple of days ago. I'm not normally not quoting the papers as a source of authority, but I'm doing it this time because there the author, a guy called Stephen Gendel, asked the question whether the Federal Reserve will actually destroy the nation and cause violent civil war in the United States. And looking at it from Europe, I know that the whole issue of possession of weapons is regarded completely different in the United States than in Europe. But you know, if you have a complete layoff process of police, firemen, at the same time people are being laid off from prisons because there is no money to maintain them inside, naturally you have an explosion of criminality, of crime. And you know, when people are being advised to take care of their own security and buy weapons, well, I mean, projecting this a little bit longer in the future, you know, this could lead to violent civil war, even a breakup of the United States. In the same way, you know, the situation in Europe, Spain is dying right now. Greece will never be able to pay back the money which was given by the EU and European governments. You have the danger of a disintegration of Italy. So, you know, I think that we are in a period of history, you know, where it is very, very clear that only a very sober looking at what is can prevent a disaster.
And Helga, let me pick up on that point you just made in terms of the potential for disintegration, because if you look at the United States and see what you just said, that with cities no longer able to provide protection, either police or fire protection, you actually are moving into a point where you literally have neighborhood gangs that would be the source of protection. I mean, this is very much like the Dark Ages with local privatized militias. But the other point to that is that it also brings up the danger of ripping up the Constitution and going to an extra-legal police state. This is the kind of thing you're talking about then.
Well, yeah, I mean, what we are watching here is the European Union. They have already plans where they expect mass unrest and violent mass unrest and the potential use not only of the police but also a privatized, you know, sort of military. Mm-hmm. We have made recently an interview with a police trade unionist here, in head of a trade union in police trade union in Germany, who said that the way things are going is the police is being dismantled, the army is being trained to be used against the own population, and what they are worried about is not only a police state, but some kind of a military coup. If you look at the situation in France right now, for days, if not weeks, day after day, 3 million, 4 million people are taking the streets, protesting the cutdown of the living standard in the form of prolonging the age until people can have pension. And, you know, in a certain sense, this is out of control already. Sarkozy already, you know, deployed the gendarmerie and basically ruled that a certain personnel of a certain refinery had to maintain their plant or else they would face 5 years in prison. I mean, what we are looking at is really the disintegration of the social fabric of entire states. And, you know, I think people really have to remember that if you have a breakdown crisis, the danger of fascism is very, very immediate. And I think it is very, very instructive to actually look what happened in the 30s, because you in the United States were lucky. You had Franklin D. Roosevelt, you know, who implemented the Glass-Steagall standard and had the Pecora Commission investigate who was responsible for the crash of 29 and the Depression. And then with the TVA program and the New Deal, got the United States out of the Depression. But in Europe, unfortunately, people were going the other way by implementing brutal austerity, the Brüning government, and then, you know, the unemployment exploded. And then soon you had not only Mussolini, but you had Hitler, Franco, the Pétain government. And this was then what led to World War II. So people have to understand that once you have a breakdown crisis and you have a fascist austerity, this can only lead to a tragedy. And people at that time completely misjudged the situation. I was just looking today at some old research I was doing. And, you know, in before 1933 and the appointment of Hitler as a chancellor through Hindenburg, there were maybe three individuals who had a clear sight of what would happen. All the others had completely illusions. And it is quite a historical phenomena how people misjudged the situation before Hitler. For example, I give you one quote. On the 15th of January 1933, Reichschancellor Kurt von Schleicher, the last chancellor before Hitler, he said on the 15th of January, Herr Hitler no longer is a problem. His movement has stopped to be a political danger. The whole matter is settled and the sorrow of the past. Now, obviously, you know, the trade unions thought, you know, Hitler would be gone by the next election. The Social Democrats said, oh, this is a minor problem compared to what we had to go through before. And the communists thought that the social fascists, namely the Social Democrats, were the problem. And they all had a rude awakening because it took exactly something like 4 weeks until you had the Reichstagsbrand. And then you had a whole bunch of assassinations within the NSDAP. And then shortly thereafter, you had a full-fledged dictatorship. So I think, you know, people really must understand that the historical moment of breakdown crisis, because what people overlooked in Germany in 1933, they only looked at this Hitler, they made fun out of him, they said, oh, he's just a banal charlatan, he is intellectually very weak. But what they completely overlooked was that the whole process which had led to this situation was the Versailles Treaty, imposing this debt regime on Germany, you know, which then made the rise of Hitler possible. And the powers of the Versailles Treaty, they were playing the whole situation from the outside. And, you know, that factor has to be seen because the financial forces in the tradition of that Versailles regime are still in existence today.
Yeah, we see the
so
same.
Don't just...
The same forces are running the Obama administration. I want to come back to this question of illusion in a moment, but I want to encourage our listeners, if they have questions, we will take emails today for Helga Zepp LaRouche. You can send your questions to us at radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio, R-A-D-I-O, at LaRouchePub, LaRouchePub.com. Now, Helga, you mentioned this question of illusions. And we saw that, obviously, in throughout Europe in the 30s and the whole question of the misjudging of what was actually behind Hitler. This is one of the important points that your husband has been making in the United States repeatedly today, that Obama is not just a slightly off-the-wall character, but he's actually doing what is being laid out for him in this crisis. And I wonder if you would just pick that up, and then we can, because we have to get at these illusions. People think, well, maybe we give Obama a little more time, or we hear this a lot. They say, well, after the elections, the Republicans might have the majority in the Congress, and then they can work with Obama, or they can stop Obama. And these kinds of illusions in the past have led to absolute catastrophe. So I wonder if you'd comment on that.
Well, I mean... In a certain sense, I think it's just cowardice because, you know, when the election campaign took place in 2008, we were looking at Obama and watched, you know, what kinds of monies he would get from Wall Street, from hedge funds, from George Soros, the whole involvement of Move On in his campaign. Mm-hmm. And, you know, basically, you know, we didn't trust that anything good would come from him. But when he was president, my husband basically said, okay, now he's president and he deserves to be supported and we will give him all support he's needing. especially because he was Obama was invoking Lincoln and Roosevelt.
Right.
So you know, I mean, you could have the hope that he would follow his own promises. But then very, very quickly it became clear that he was doing exactly the same thing what George Bush, W. Bush, was doing, and more of it, namely the bailout of the banks at the expense of the population. And you have an explosion of rage in the population, not only in the United States, but also in Europe. Not in all countries, but in France for sure, in Spain, in Portugal, in Greece. This is all nourished by, you know, an understanding of more and more people that this whole thing is a fake. Why should be the livelihood and existence of people be sacrificed for what? So that the millionaires become more rich, that you have more billionaires and millionaires after 39 months of the crisis, and you have more people jobless, homeless, and without any medical care. I think the people realize that this is the biggest fraud ever, and you know, in a certain sense, Obama is the cover for all of that.
Let me ask you something on that, because there's been a resurgence of discussion in the last days around the housing crisis, because the efforts that were made by first Hank Paulson and then Geithner, Barney Frank, Obama, where they all promised they were going to deal with the housing situation. What we now see is that there will be well over 1 million homes seized this year. There was a record number in September, over 102,000 homes seized. Now there's the scandal that the homes that are being seized by people who don't even own them. And this, of course, has led to a scandal. And then on top of that, the banks are now saying they're going to need another bailout, maybe $70 to $200 billion. And Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is lining up for another $300 billion. There's no end to these bailouts. How is this seen in Europe? Do people from Europe see any way out of this in the United States?
Well, I think what people are really worried about is that the United States disintegrates. Now, there are some people who are, you know, actually, I don't know this word in English, schadenfroh, you know, who
Take
actually
pleasure
are...
in this.
Yeah, who have a secret pleasure that this may be, because they have a deep-rooted anti-Americanism, which is obviously completely insane, because the more reasonable people understand perfectly well that because of the globalization and the, you know, total connectedness of all market segments of the world economy, that if the United States goes down, then, you know, there is as much chance that Europe survives that like the famous snowball in hell, because you know, the situation in Europe is completely dependent. For example, the only economy which supposedly did well was the German economy, and the media and the politicians here lying their teeth off, saying that there is an upswing in Germany and, you know, the worst is over. But this is completely crazy, because all the export dependency of Germany, 61% of German exports go to the other European Union members. So if they go down, what does that do to German exports? Then naturally, what happens if the Chinese economy crumbles, because they are dependent on the export to the United States? And if the U.S. stops to be a consumer market because people are going bankrupt, then you can forget China. So you are looking at an unraveling of the situation. And already now, the speculators who have gotten all this bailout money, they don't put it under their mattress, but they're looking for new lucrative objects of speculation. And right now it is precious metals, it is raw materials, but it is especially agricultural raw materials. And that is already killing people, because if you have one or maybe two meals a day consisting out of wheat and bread and some you know, a little something, an increase of 30-40% is already killing off a whole number of people. And you know, unfortunately, there can be no doubt that that is the intention of some of the financial forces who are doing it, because they are so interwoven with an oligarchy which has been running the ecological swindle for you know, more than a century. And they have made very clear and stated publicly, repeatedly, they want to reduce the population from presently nearly 7 billion to 2 or less. And I think that what we see, you know, is a mixture between hardcore ideological forces who really are determined to destroy industrial nations with the pretext to save the environment, but in reality to reduce the population, because they are oligarchs at heart. And that is interwoven and mixed with greedy idiots, you know, like these bankers from Wall Street and London and Frankfurt and whatnot places, you know, who could not care less. I was by chance talking in a public transport situation last week to somebody who turned out to be an investment banker. And at one point in the discussion, he said, yeah, yeah, what you are saying is exactly what the pessimists in my area are saying, namely that the whole thing will blow out. They already have bought their house in the countryside and plan to grow food in an autark way. They already bought their gun and they think they can get through this way. And I said, well, I hope they also bought shotguns, because, you know, when you have a scarcity of food and hungry people, you cannot grow your food in your little house and think you can. And then he said, yes, I agree. We already talked about it. If it gets to that, then they will steal our seats as well. So here you have these people, you know, they have no, absolutely no empathy for the suffering of millions of people, and they're just trying to eat caviar as long as they can. And if the Titanic goes under tomorrow, so be it.
And well, Helga, these are the same people who are pushing in the United States anyway, Geithner, Bernanke, pushing what they call quantitative easing, with the argument that, well, there's no inflation. And yet you look at the collapse of the dollar, and you see the dollar's collapsing because of the hyperinflation of the money supply. But there's back and forth in Europe. You have Trichet one day saying no quantitative easing, then the next day they're easing. But at the same time, there's a real push for austerity. And we saw this with a vengeance in Great Britain this week with the announcement of the austerity regime. We've seen it with Greece, with Spain. Is there fight coming? We see the fighting in France. I mean, obviously, it's not just the retirement age, because a lot of young people are involved. Is there an ability to fight this inside Europe?
Well, I think there is, but I think that the very fact that Europe is in the straitjacket of the Maastricht Treaty, I think that the recent summit between Sarkozy and Merkel in Caen just demonstrated that, you know, they're completely incompetent. What they decided is, you know, to have some sort of compromise by which, you know, semi-automatic sanctions can be imposed on countries who do not fulfill the Maastricht criteria. Now, that obviously is the case for Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, but soon France, and then Germany will be de facto the only country which will have to bail out all of these other countries, because when they signed the European Financial Stability Pact, there is actually a clause which says that if some member countries have to leave because they can't you know, fulfill the conditions anymore, then the others have to take over. Now, there is no provision that there is a limit to that. So, de facto, Germany is the only surplus country. Then that would mean that Germany will have to pay for it all. I think when the German population realizes that, and there is new talk for new bailout packages for Spain and maybe another one for Greece,
right,
I think we will have a social explosion. And unfortunately, I don't think it will be very pretty, because, you know, I think what the oligarchy is doing right now is being perfectly aware that, you know, that if you had real resistance fighting for the common good, fighting for the living standard, then, you know, if millions of people take the streets, then, you know, no army can be sufficient to crush that. But what they are doing right now in Germany is unbelievable, what we discovered. You may have heard about this protests against the station in Stuttgart, Stuttgart 21.
Crazy green.
Well, it's mixed with some people from Stuttgart who are anthroposophs and greenies themselves. But the main thing is being shipped in there through activists organizations, like one called Campact DE, where the founder of it, a certain person called Christoph Bautz, actually went at the beginning of 2000 to the United States to study MoveOn and to study how George Soros actually financed the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, the Rose Revolution in Georgia, and similar destabilizations in Central Asia. And they have now basically set up throughout Europe such activist organizations, which are all financed by, you know, it goes through various channels. One, for example, is something called the European Climate Foundation, on the board of which are sitting quite unbelievable individuals. But the so-called funding partners are all the top hedge funds and locusts from Great Britain. Arcadia Fund, where you have Jacob Rothschild sitting in. Then you have some other hedge fund called the Children Initiative Fund. So the top hedge funds from London are financing the destabilization, not only of the building of this main station in Stuttgart, but the blocking of all kinds of other infrastructure projects throughout Germany. They want to stop all coal plants, nuclear plants anyway. They have now called for a hot autumn and a huge demonstration on the 5th of November when the nuclear waste transport is supposed to be transported from France, The Hague, to Gorleben. And they have now set up literally hundreds of training camps to train these people how to do these kinds of actions. Now, this is really unbelievable. I mean, if you think that Germany without all of these projects is going to stop to be an industrial nation, and that without Germany as an industrial nation, you can kiss Europe goodbye, then you can actually see that these hedge funds right now have de facto declared war against Germany.
Yeah. That's where you see the genocidal intent. Look, I have two quick questions for you more just on the crisis, and then I want to get into the solutions, because I know you've been doing some traveling to make sure that the solutions are presented to people in Germany, and I know that what we've done with NWAPA in the United States with Mr. LaRouche's pushing of the basement to get material out there, we actually are putting forward an alternative, but I think it's important that people keep in mind we're not going to get there unless Obama is removed. Let me first bring up the Obama question, because back on April 11th, 2009, Lyndon LaRouche identified him as a narcissist, a Nero figure. I think many people are beginning to see this now. There's the Ostermann reports coming out in the United States. Very interesting material from senior diplomatic sources like Chaz Freeman and Larry Johnson in the last couple of days. I know there was a tremendous illusion about Obama when he first came into office in January 2009. What's the sense of Obama now from Europe? Are people beginning to see this character, the Hitler in the bunker, the Nero figure?
Well, I mean, I think that the media still have a relative rep on the whole discussion of the United States. I mean, people in Europe, except if they go to our websites, have a hard time to find out, you know, what is going on with this situation in the United States. I think what is happening now is that basically the coverage is, okay, Obama, you know, is a huge disappointment. He's not different from Bush. Then there was a big report in Spiegel and FAZ last week on these secret commandos in Pakistan and the drones So basically, people were saying, yeah, okay, maybe Obama promised not to torture people anymore, like Guantanamo. He's just killing them with drones.
More humane.
So that came out. And then you had another article in the Frankfurter Rundschau 2 weeks ago, basically with the headline, "Is Obama a failed president?" So I think it is slowly sinking in. But I think people are not thinkers. You know, the majority of people don't even consider that they made such a total error. Mm-hmm. But people who know us basically acknowledge that we were on the mark all the time, and that, you know, basically we said beware of this so-called magician, because, you know, he's just a souffle.
Well, and just very quickly on that, there's another example, which is this whole question that's come up now on Haiti, where Lyndon LaRouche warned back in February that if the Army Corps of Engineers is not brought in, if people are not removed to higher ground, if there's not an effort to deal with the problems of waste and sewage and total breakdown, you would have contagious disease that would spread like wildfire. Now there are 130 acknowledged deaths from cholera, thousands of people with cholera, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, in areas where cholera is spreading. And this is, in fact, the genocide that he was warning about. I know there was a lot of effort made by aid groups in France and Germany, especially France, to do something in Haiti. But it would seem that this is another way to get this point across, that this is, in fact, the malign neglect of this administration, that it is Obama's fault that this is happening.
Yeah, I think that the whole condition of the third world in general, you know, I mean, in a certain sense, I think that the fact that you have 20 million people in deaths, in danger of dying of starvation in Niger, Chad, and nothing is being done about it. To the contrary, Obama came out and supported the referendum and possible secession of the South of Sudan, you know, which could really throw this whole part of the world into a complete nightmare, because you could have unrest spreading on top of starvation. And I think it's just, you know, I think it's really clear that this man has absolutely no sympathy for Africa.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the first point in avoiding a tragedy is making it clear to people that a tragedy is coming. And the second point is getting people to recognize that unless they act, the tragedy will be fulfilled. Now, what you've been doing leading in Europe, and what Lyndon LaRouche has been doing in the United States with infrastructure, with the discussion of the potential to totally transform the world, this goes back to some initiatives you took years ago with the whole question of space exploration. We had a Croft Erica conference in Virginia. How do we inspire people to get them to get out of the pettiness and the fears and start thinking about the actual potential for human beings on this planet?
Well, I think that the most important thing is that, you know, people don't just live their lives as if it would be in the soap opera, you know, with no beginning and no end, just on and on. But that sometimes you have to step back and say, okay, what is the world looking like? And anybody who is not a complete moral moron must see that the world right now is in such an unjust condition, you know, that it cannot remain that like that. When I, you know, made my first trip around the world in 1971 on a freighter. As a matter of fact, as a journalist, I had the opportunity to do that. And I saw the condition of Africa then, which was, you know, in a certain sense, not as severe as now, but also the situation in Asia. I came back from the trip and said, look, this is not justified. We have to have real development. And then fortunately, I met relatively immediately afterwards the theories of Mr. LaRouche in the university in Berlin. And I said, that is it. Exactly, that is it. Because he was the only one who was talking about infrastructure development for Africa, Latin America, Asia. And, you know, basically then, you know, I joined his movement. And since almost 40 years, we have been working now on very concrete development projects for every part of the world. And I think that that is what you have to do. You have to imagine that if you could design programs for people, how they could live, you know, what kinds of agriculture, what kinds of forestry, what kinds of industrial development, scientific development, you would provide people. And when you start to do that and you have a concrete idea that there is an alternative, that, for example, all this discussion by Mrs. Merkel that her policies are without an alternative, that is completely wrong. Because, you know, you could absolutely abandon this bailout policy of the banks and speculation, and you could start to really develop the world as we are doing it right now with what de facto is a program for the reconstruction of the world economy. Because if you take the combination of the Navapa project, the Plino project for Mexico, then this program which we just added with the closing of the Darien Gap, the whole development of South America, together with the Eurasian Land Bridge, the Bering Strait, the filling of the Aral Lake, the filling of the Chad Lake as a pool for irrigation of the entire Sahel zone. Actually, you know, all these projects, or most of these projects, are in the closets of the engineer firms since decades.
Sure.
And if you look what blocked them, you know, what blocked Navapa, it was the World Wildlife Fund for Nature of Prince Philip and Prince Bernhard. If you look, for example, we just had a very good event in Frankfurt, where one of the speakers was a guest from Ethiopia who presented a perfectly wonderful plan for a dam which would provide large parts of Ethiopia with power, with irrigation, with agriculture. And then he also presented an attack on that plan by whom? By the German coordinator for the same European climate foundation, which is financing the anti-nuclear movement in Germany and the Stuttgart anti-station movement. Mm-hmm. And they are behind the attack on this dam in Ethiopia. Now, if you see that, you know, there is actually one common hand behind that, then you understand that what we are really involved is a fight between those people who want to, you know, kill off billions of people to preserve their privileges as an oligarchy, and those people who are fighting for world development. And I think what we need, therefore, is a very conscious worldwide movement for development of people who say it was a mistake not to have built Navapa, it was a mistake not to have done all of these development projects which were already well established in the 50s, in the 60s, and it's now high time to undo that mistake. And I think if we do that and you fight for that with a passion, I think, you know, the majority of the people are on our side. They want to live.
Well, but let's get to the deeper level on that, because obviously if we're dealing simply with here are the economic policies that could change this versus here's where we're going, most people presumably would choose make the right choice, although they'd have stupid arguments about where's the money coming from and things like that, which we could answer. But we're actually dealing with this deeper, more profound question of the corruption of a population that's induced to think small. And I've heard you give presentations before that I think get to this in a really interesting way, where you talk about the question of mankind still being in a prepubescent period, an infantile or a child stage, as opposed to being adult. And that for that, what Lyndon LaRouche has been talking about recently is that you have to fight for this idea of scientific creativity and classical artistic creativity. How does that work? How can this question of giving people the sense of bigness again, how do we get them out of the smallness, Helga?
Well, I think that the best thing is what Lynn is doing with the people in the LIM, in the LaRouche Youth Movement, and his so-called basement crew. Because, if people actually develop the sweetness of creativity, of, knowing how to use your mind for the common good, and to develop concepts which get you deeper and deeper into the secrets of how the universe functions, what are the laws of the universe, that it is man's unique ability to discover these laws deeper and deeper and more perfect, and that there is actually no limit to the self-perfection of the human mind once you pursue that course, well, then you have a completely different identity than if you are a consumer. If you just think, that you have to have the goods your neighbor possesses, and you have to have privileges, and you have to eat caviar, and you have to drive a Porsche, and all of these things, then you are not actually human. Then you are just a being which is basically a predator on other human beings. And I think that is actually a mental disease. Mm-hmm. I mean, from my standpoint, since these people cannot judge the consequences of their doing. And, this banker I was mentioning before was a typical example, because he had zero perception of that he is doing or he's participating in something evil, absolutely absent that understanding. But people who do not understand reality are insane. I mean, what is the clinical definition of people who don't understand the world around them? In my view, it's insanity. So the first step is therefore to get people to think themselves, to not take their opinion from the media or the neighbor or the peer group, but to rediscover the art of own judgment, of own creativity, of own research, of self-thinking. And I think that once people see that, you can inspire them. And I think that we are right now in a period of time where people realize this whole system is a complete fraud, and therefore I think we have a chance to make our voice heard in this moment and actually catalyze a change. I think we are at an end of an era. There is no question in my mind that we are right now as much at the end of an era like at the end of the Middle Ages, and Nicholas of Cusa, who was sort of the towering mind of the new age, coming, he was very conscious. He said, I know that an era is ending, and I know that my ideas are the inspiration for the new time to come, because I'm thinking things which nobody before me was thinking. And I think we are at such a moment. The system of oligarchy is coming to an end. There is no way how the system will survive. The only question is, will the world plunge into chaos for several generations, like Haiti, like Niger, like, I also have the vision that in the end there will be only armed gangs left over fighting for, the last crumbs of bread, because there is no farming going on anymore. And, I have a vision of how a dark age could look like. You just have to look at the pictures of Bruegel and Bosch, where you see crazy people being painted there from the 14th century. And you can see that we are on the verge. I give you two examples. In Germany, and it's probably the same in the United States too, you have now 8-year-old pupils who send themselves via their handies, their mobile, hardcore pornos.
Yeah.
Now, this is going on everywhere, and I can assure you this is a sign of a dark age, because, if children are not protected from such ugliness. They have no chance to develop a healthy mind. And, you know, I think people who tolerate that and are indifferent about that, these are signs of a dark age in which we are in already. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a certain sense, I think that what you have to do instead, you have to reject that and you have to say, no, I'm going to be a self-thinking human being and I'm going to pursue a life in which beauty means something, in which children have a chance, and in which, you know, basically I'm fighting for a cultural renaissance because mm-hmm. it's all there. And we in Germany, in a certain sense, we would be so, rich, you know, because a lot of these things sure. have been written in German or composed in German. And, you know, I think we should be able to make that available again in a real way for the youth as well.
Well, Helga, we have a question on that from the email. Someone asked about the Monday demonstrations that brought down the DDR, the Honecker regime, just over 20 years ago. And the question is there some way to spark that again, that same spirit? You've written extensively about that, the lost opportunity of 1989. Does that permanently demoralize a population, or can they rekindle that spirit?
Well, I think the problem is right now that, you know, I had initiated in 2004 new Monday demonstrations against this absolute terrible so-called Hartz IV mm-hmm. law, which was this idea that if you become unemployed, you first have to use up everything you possess, from your life insurance to your house to your car, before you get any unemployment money. So it is a very brutal expropriation, and people who plunge into Hartz IV normally have no chance to ever get out, and they are being thrown into poverty forever. So it's a completely unjust thing. This was done by Schröder, the Red Queen government, on behalf of the banks at the time. And I launched this Monday demonstrations against it, but then there was a absolutely orchestrated way to trying to subvert it, and eventually it was it grew very quickly to more than 100,000 people, but then it was subverted and it died down. And I think the problem is that right now, you know, such a thing can only happen spontaneously. I think in France it's happening in a way because there the population is in a mode of resistance and insurrection against the government. I cannot predict how quickly that will affect Germany. What I see in Germany right now is that the oligarchy is funding, channeling money to these activists to try to divert the issue and change the subject to, you know, fight against a station. I mean, it's insane. The environment would profit greatly if this station would be underground, because you could use the area for flowers and whatnot, you know. Yeah. But these people are completely irrational.
Well, in the United States, you would think if someone's a greenie and an environmentalist, they'd support NWAPA because they want to green the desert. But apparently they're worried about cacti and sand. So they're actually brownies in the United States. Well, Helga, let me bring up another question on this, because we're approaching an important day, the birthday of Friedrich Schiller. You're the founder of the Schiller Institute. And, of course, Schiller had quite a bit to say about these kinds of conditions and these kinds of battles in his time. But I think it's important, again, on this question of how you uplift people, that you recently had with the Busso in Germany, a performance of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the fourth movement, the Schiller's setting Wann die Freude by Beethoven. And it had quite an effect. And in the United States, we're doing work now to vindicate Mozart as not just a great composer, but a brilliant tragedian, and on top of that, a hero for standing up and fighting to defend Vienna from the onslaught of an Anglo-Venetian attack. So culture is not merely something that's extraneous, but it's actually part of how history is made. And I wonder if you'd comment on that.
Well, in the case of Mozart and your work on Don Giovanni, I think, you know, the text of the opera is one of the most unbelievable attacks on the perversion of the nobility, because that is how the culture is, and the culture of the oligarchy. And Friedrich Schiller, if you take all his works, from his dramas to his theoretical writings to even his poetry, it is an unrelenting effort to turn small people into big people, right, to fight against tyranny of all kinds, and to basically fight for the highest ideal of the state, in which the citizen is actually, you know, the conscious state citizen taking responsibility for history as a world historical individual. And I think I can only advise people to reread or read for the first time these writings by Schiller on the sublime, or on the question of beauty, or on the question of the moral character of theater, because his whole effort was, you know, to take ordinary people, bakers, you know, people who are working in nursing homes, just little people, and confront them with the large issues of mankind, you know, put them in a position where they would have to decide, or they have to identify with the person, a main actor on the stage, if their action would determine what will be the fate of their nation for generations to come. And by somehow forcing people to take that position, you know, transforming the audience. And I think that that is exactly what is needed, because, you know, I think that the idea that everybody should be a king, like the famous dialogue between Prince Philip and Don Carlos and Don Posa in Don Carlos, you know, where basically Posa says to Philip, "Be a king of a million kings." You know, this is a very beautiful metaphor for that everybody is a beautiful soul. Everybody is a genius. And, you know, Schiller very, very consciously contrasted that to the Jacobean idea that equality comes, you know, basically by chopping everybody's head off in the revolution. And he contrasted that and said, be a king of a million kings. And I think in America, people should, you know, understand that, because the American Revolution and the German classical period were two of the greatest periods in history actually occurring at the same time. And Schiller basically was absolutely inspired by the American Revolution. And he said the issue of creating a just state is the most debated issue of his decade. He said that in the 1880s. So I think what we have to do is we have to revive the thinking of the founding fathers of the German classical period, and, you know, basically apply it for today, because why should people not think like Mozart or Schiller? Why should they not be creative? Why should we not have new classical compositions in poetry, in drama? And why should we not do what the Italian Renaissance did after the dark age of the 14th century, making a new golden Renaissance? I think the first step is to throw out a lot of modern, you know, entertainment, throw it out entirely, and replace it with great historical performances of operas, of theater, and just recognize, you know, how much this garbage by the globalization has affected your own mind, and get rid of it.
And I think part of that, which is the major point, or one of the major points that Lyndon LaRouche has made on this question of Don Giovanni and Mozart, is that when you're looking at an opera, as you said with Don Giovanni, you're looking at real history. That tragedy that works is real history, and it shows the person in the audience that this is, that it's these axioms that held back the society on the stage that led to the tragedy, which are gripping the minds of the people in the audience as well. And from that standpoint, this emphasis that Lynn has been making on the fight for immortality, to actually recognize that one of the things that's important with a great infrastructure project is that you may not complete it in your lifetime, for example, Nuapa or getting to Mars, but that by taking up this fight and fighting for the future, if you're not fighting for the future, you can be made little to the point that you'll dig around in a little garden to try and produce one turnip to survive. So I think this is one of the things we can learn from this, this question of that it's the fight for the future that gives your life meaning.
Yeah, and I think that the most important thing is, you know, in order to, you know, have a sense of what immortality means. Well, first of all, you know, I mean, have you thought about all the people who you met in your lifetime who already passed away? Great people. I mean, I had the fortune of having met quite a number of extraordinary individuals in many different countries. And, you know, somehow you have to be aware that what we do today will make their lives little more little or bigger. Because if we do our job well, then their heritage will grow. And if we do our job not at all, then they have lived in vain. I think this is a big burden because if my beloved Schiller or my beloved Kusa or Leibniz, you know, if they have worked, you know, for nothing or for little, or if they really were the founding stones of a new era in civilization, it depends on me. So I think, you know, people have to understand that we are in the middle of the past and the future, and that the only way how we can throw in our whole identity is by feeling a passion for civilization, a passion for mankind. And, you know, I think that's something you have to train, because most people really are like crippled plants who can only feel very small things. But I think you can also do what Lessing said, or even Confucius before him, that you can switch on love if you decide to do so. And, you know, Kusa, for example, Nicholas of Kusa, you know, who in many ways was a stepping stone for all of modern age in terms of the nation state, in terms of natural science. I mean, he was a typical or maybe the person who had this absolute passion for the community of peoples of his time. And he had this idea of the development of the macrocosm, meaning that all nations had the right to equal development and encouraging each other's through a dialogue among the best traditions among them. And, you know, in a certain sense, I think we have to have this mobilization of love, of passion for other countries, for, you know, not just our own family and not our own situation. But I think that that ability to take the fate of mankind at this point where it is so much in danger into our own heart and mind will be probably the most important decisive factor. Because once you feel that love for mankind, the fear goes away. And I think it is the fear which is what is crippling people and say, oh, you know I should do this, but I don't want to stick my neck out because I could get trouble, so I better keep low in a low profile. I think that that fear can only be smashed by the conscious decision to be a lover of mankind, to be a passionate defender of civilization, because it is beautiful. And the work in natural science, in astronomy, biophysics and other areas is so important, because when you do it in a serious way, you end up like Johannes Kepler, that you recognize that, you know, this order of civilization, of the universe, of the physical universe, is so well thought out and so beautiful that there must be a creator who has created that. And that creator was also one who had a tremendous love, because otherwise he couldn't have made a world so beautiful. And once you understand that you are a microcosm in this macrocosm, and that you are in the image of God when you replicate the most noble ability of man, of God, which is his ability to create, well, then you feel free and you have passion to do the things which are of value to civilization and which help to bring civilization on.
And Helga, we've run out of time on that, but I think that's a beautiful way to end it, because it's the overcoming of fear that will give people the ability to go out and aggressively fight right now to save the United States, to save Germany. In the United States, it means we have to get the 25th Amendment invoked so we can get Obama out and get the LaRouche plan implemented. We have, I should just mention, on the LaRouche PAC website, you can go there and see almost every day now new videos that are demonstrating precisely the principles that Helga was just discussing in terms of NWAPA and the extended NWAPA. Also, 2 weeks from today, Lyndon LaRouche will be giving his next international webcast on November 6th. And if you live in Texas or California, get out the vote for Keisha Rogers and Summer Shields. And so, Helga, thank you very much for joining us today. And join us next week again. We'll be back with the LaRouche Show every Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Thanks for listening.